Hey, ding-dongs, I'm Jamie.
I'm Richard.
And this is Explain It to Jamie, the political comedy podcast in which I, Jamie, a politically innocent but curious young man, have the complicated political happenings of the world explained to me by my politically savvy friend, Richard Lamb.
That's me.
That's you.
All right. Jamie, what is it we're getting into this week?
Oh, man, we're doing another one. We're gonna do another one. You still didn't do shit about the other one.
It's true, we haven't.
No, man, we're going back to back. We're gonna do, well, back to sex to back.
Back to sex to back, baby. Just yeah, like Drake said.
Climate change, part two.
Woo!
Yeah.
Okay. We literally ran out of time as we were talking about climate change last time because we spent too much time talking about plant poop.
Yeah.
So now we're going to talk about all the really sexy parts of climate change, like international treaties
and taxes.
Oh,
careful, Richard.
Tits.
Oh, Richard, no!
Earth
tits. Going.
Earth tits, that is.
Okay, we just lost our PG rating. That
yeah,
was
we
long
did not
gone.
Have a PG rating. Unless gone. PG stands for pretty great. It does not. Spoiler alert.
No, we have R rating. R for rail.
Rail?
Like rail, yeah.
Like the method of travel?
I meant like real, but like a cool guy would
I
say
see.
It.
I see. Yeah. Like rail. Like
faux rail.
Nice.
Yeah, man. We got a lot into like what is climate change, how does it happen, and how it's going to destroy us and everyone we love.
Yeah, and if you're having a bit of a sad day, you need a little pick-me-up, definitely check out that first episode.
Boy, oh boy.
I believe it is 32.
Episode 32, that's right.
It's about what is climate change and why is it happening. So check that out. You have to listen to that before you listen to this, or this isn't going to make very much sense, unless you're Bill Nye, the science guy, in which case,
thank you for listening,
yeah, welcome,
Bill.
Welcome, Mr. Nye.
Yeah, let's we'd love to have you on.
We'll talk about the political side of climate change
Can you imagine if we ever got like Bill Nye and Neil deGrasse Tyson like in your kitchen on the podcast?
I don't think we would be able to record over the sound of my literally constant cycles of orgasm. No. They're cool dudes.
Yeah.
They're cool dudes.
They're cool dudes.
Yeah.
All for science.
I got beef with Neil sometimes, to be honest.
Oh, yeah?
I feel like Neil could be a bit of a, like, dingus.
Ooh.
Like, when he was, like, his whole job is to, like, make people excited about science, but, like, when the solar eclipse happened, he was like, solar eclipses happen all the time. All of you need to not be excited about this. It was like, bro, you got one job.
Right. Right.
And it's to be my science jester.
Sure.
So stop having your own opinions about things and dance for me, science man.
Yeah, let me bask in the glory that is the moon and the sun
lining up
for a brief moment.
I'm entitled for you to act in exactly the way I expect you to act. And don't you dare violate that contract.
I understand there are infinite universes and not everything also means nothing. But for the love of God, let me have fun with my space lines.
And on that note, let's fucking kick this theme song off.
Yeah, take that theme song.
So, Jamie, what do you know about what's being done to fight climate change?
I mean, probably not much. You know, like I know sort of what is sold to me from the. I know about Elon Musk and his efforts and his publicized efforts. I know, you know, there are people that advocate for different kinds of energy consumption, but I don't really know the ins and outs of like policy or anything like that. And I try and I look on YouTube for like good strong arguments, but I find, you know, there's sort of strong arguments from my point of view, from someone who doesn't know the ins and outs of the science and stuff, from both sides. And I go, like, I can't really discern. I think that, you know, clean energy is better than awful, dirty energy just from a point of objectivity. But I don't know how to fix that, really.
Right. Okay, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of hand-wringing about climate change. There's a lot of, like, delayed action. The truth is that even though there's an overwhelming scientific consensus that global warming is happening, there's an overwhelming amount of evidence that the oil industry is responsible for it and, like, the primary contributor of it, and there's an overwhelming amount of evidence that, like, the most industrialized countries contribute the most to climate change, and that disasters are going to start increasing, and you know, the world's agriculture within a couple of decades is going to seriously be affected.
Mm-hmm.
There's still not a sense of urgency about it. And I mean, listening to any of Donald Trump's rhetoric about climate change, he's literally a skeptic. Like, he's like, in the way that your like dumb uncle is like a climate skeptic, where he doesn't have any information. All he does says is like, ISIS is a problem, and they're worried about climate change. He's like somewhere in Syria, in the middle of a field with a single blade of grass growing out of it, there's an angry 19-year-old with a machete who's really frustrated with America. But you know, I can't muster the imagination to think of how a warmer climate might possibly affect all of us, you know what I mean? But like the fact that somewhere there's an angry brown kid that occupies 100% of my mental space at any given moment.
Right.
Fortunately, Donald Trump's not in charge of the whole world, just like a decent chunk of it. So there is stuff being done. So let's talk about Paris.
Yeah.
So you've heard of the Paris Accord, right?
I've heard of it, yes.
Yeah, so the Paris Accord was the second... Really, the second attempt to create a global framework for combating climate change and reducing all of our carbon emissions.
Right.
It's leapfrogging off of the back of the Kyoto Protocol, which you've probably also heard of.
I sure have.
So the Kyoto Protocol was the first attempt for everybody to come together, industrialized nations and developing nations, as they call them, and get control of our emissions.
Yeah. Whatever happened to that Kyoto Protocol?
Well, that's a great question, Jamie.
I remember it was a big deal at the time.
That's right.
And everybody was like, rah, rah, we did it.
That's right. So the Kyoto Protocol was drafted in 1997,
uh-huh.
and it came into effect in 2005. So it was kind of right when our, like, you know, adolescence was ending, and we were kind of like entering adulthood is when this came into effect.
I probably missed a lot of it because that was the year the NHL 97 came out for Sega Genesis.
That was a write-off.
Ooh.
I was actually an NHL 98 kid. Like, I played a lot of 98.
Yeah, yeah. I had 95 and 97.
You could do this cheese-ass move in 98 where you could just fucking take the puck straight to the red line and shoot from, like, almost an exactly parallel spot to the net, and it would go in, like, every time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was like this total exploit you could do.
In NHL 97, you could take the puck up, like you take it up to the net and to the corner, and then you just turn right very suddenly and shoot at that exact moment, and it always went in.
Yeah.
I won a game like something like 92-0 or something
nice.
Like that. And every time I did score, I would yell to myself in the basement, for climate change!
Yeah, that's right. That's actually how we're going to win climate change. If we can make the whole world a hockey rink, we will have successfully combated global warming.
Yeah.
So the Kyoto Protocol was the first try at like getting all the nations together to do something about climate change, and it's generally considered to have sort of been a failure.
Right.
It's an important success in other ways. So let's talk about it a little bit. So the Kyoto Protocol was a bunch of nations agreeing to reduce their emissions to 5% less than they were in 1990. 5% below the 1990 level.
Great. Yeah, I want to lose 5 pounds by Christmas.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like by 2020,
right,
or by 2010, we're going to reduce our emissions, the amount of emissions we emit every year, by 5% below 1990 levels. Now, it's important to just already start talking about this target. So we're not saying, that's not even starting to reverse global warming, right? But the idea is you're trying to get to a point where we've peaked the emissions that we've been releasing, where we've changed our economies enough so that every year we're going to start emitting less and less carbon, right? So that finally the graph is going to start
going down.
This is the thing. It's not necessarily the graph of how much carbon's in the air. That's going to change how steep it's going, right? For those who can't see, none of you can see because this is a podcast. I like drew a line that's like at a 45-degree angle, and then I made it suddenly start going at like a 15-degree angle. So it's not going up nearly as fast per year, and that'll buy us a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can start working on the problem of getting the carbon out of the atmosphere. So in a way, the global fight against climate change is like two steps. The first step is let's get to the point where we've peaked our emissions. We're in every year there's going to be less emissions than there were before. And once we've gotten to that point, we can start getting the carbon back out of the air and trying to reduce ourselves back to the pre-coal, pre-industrial revolution oxygen level.
Get on out of here, exactly. Yeah, carbon.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we're walking here, carbon. It's mostly, yeah, it's the island of Manhattan is going to be a real leader of climate change. So the Kyoto Protocol set the target, a hard target of saying you got to reduce your emissions 5% below 1990 levels. And kind of also created a series of systems by which this could happen. And this is really important because we still use these systems today. So the key thing is the system that's, you've definitely heard of this. It's called cap and trade.
Oh, yeah.
You heard of cap and trade?
I sure have.
Do you know what cap and trade is?
He's the cousin of Captain America.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, so, no, a cap and trade system, it refers to like essentially a double prong system. So how it works is they basically turned not emitting carbon into like a kind of money that then you can like exchange among countries. So what it means here, the first part is cap, right? So all that means is that every single country has a cap to how much carbon it's allowed to emit. And that level is the level that will get you to 5% below 1990 levels. So that's right. Like the cap on how much carbon each individual country is allowed to emit. And that is different for every country because they all emit different levels of carbon, mm-hmm. right? If you go, but then, you know, scientists realized that because global warming is a global problem, there was a way around basically forcing every single country to like radically scale back its carbon usage right away. And what they did was they said, they created this new currency called carbon credits. You've probably heard of those too.
Yeah, I think so.
Like emission reduction credits, carbon credits. And what those refer to is if you you create carbon credits by creating initiatives that either take carbon out of the atmosphere or that like create renewable energy, right? So if you have a bunch of forest plantation projects, mm-hmm. then you like earn carbon credits. And so let's say your cap is like 10 gigatons of carbon per year. Like let's say you're allowed to emit 10 gigatons of carbon a year, right. But you're actually emitting 13 gigatons with all the shit that's in your economy. Well, all you have to do is get 3 gigatons worth of carbon credits, and then your total is 10. So you just got to make it equal your cap.
Okay. We need to...
Yeah, we need to roll back.
We need to slow down, roll back.
Okay, so let's picture this.
So carbon credits.
Yes.
Everybody's got carbon credits.
Yes. Every country gets...
10.
Let's say 10 for the purpose of this. Every country gets 10.
Right.
In this case, 10 means that was what your... your 5% below 1990 level of carbon is.
Okay.
That's that number.
Right.
That's how much you're allowed to be emitting.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Right?
So you have a balance. So let's say everybody's got 10 for the sake. Then that's what your 5% below 1990 level equals.
That's
now
right.
Now we can.
That's
now,
the target.
That's the target.
Yes.
So we're allowed to, you can produce carbon in the air, but every time you do, you lose credits.
Yeah, well,
But if you create an initiative to reduce the carbon in the air, that adds credits.
Exactly. You're trying to balance your like carbon budget.
Right.
So think of it like this. If we have an economy, like I said, that say our target is 10,
right.
But our economy emits 13 worth of carbon, we're 3 over our cap, right? We're exceeding
right.
our cap. We're not meeting our obligation.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to figure out a way to reduce our carbon emission by 3.
Right.
Right? Either we like get rid of like a huge chunk of the cars on the road. Like, you know, we could have, like, that's an option. You can scale back. You can say, no more trucks, you know, this fewer airplane flights. Nobody did that. Nobody wants to do that.
Right.
That's not an idea that's in play right now.
Right,
I mean,
right.
except among, you know, radical thinkers. So the other thing you can do is get carbon out of the air. The main way to do that right now is plant more forests, because as we talked about last episode, trees absorb carbon out of the air.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you if you plant like 1 gigaton, one credit worth of forest, then you're at 12.
Right.
Right. And then finally, if you, let's say you build enough wind power to account for another one, right? Then you're down to 11. You're almost there. Right? Right. So that's how you, so countries can earn credits by like investing in clean energy or by, you know, taking carbon out of the air by planting forests or whatever. Now, let's say we've done the stuff I just said. So now we're at 11. We're almost at 10. What? How do we get that last one? You can buy them from countries that have extra ones. This is the key thing.
Right, right. So let's say... like Iceland killing the game with geothermal energy. They're like sitting on...
Let's say Iceland's like our they're like way ahead of their target.
Yeah.
So let's say their cap is 10, they're actually at 4. They have 6 credits that they can sell to other countries. And the price of a carbon credit has like a fixed price in like the marketplace among nations. So if our country would like pay $1 million per carbon credit or something, it's like cheaper than what it is. We'd pay Iceland $1 million that then they would use to like do more renewable stuff.
Right.
And then because we're paying Iceland, and because then the overall global effect is it all balances out so that everyone meets their target. Even if this person's doing 15, but then this person's only doing 5,
right,
they equal 10 each.
Right.
That's the kind of principle.
Right. Okay. And I think I may see where the issue is going. Is that like at a certain point, like, it's made up currency just like money.
Yeah, that's super correct. So all of the horrible things about capitalism have already started to exist among carbon credits, mostly that countries that found it really easy to create them, especially some developing countries, and even companies can hold them and create them sometimes, have been hoarding them. And also some companies have just been literally buying them for money and hoarding the carbon credits so that they can sell them to countries when they become more valuable. Part of the other problem is that...
Right, it's like the OG Bitcoin.
Exactly. It is like exactly like a Bitcoin. It's like any cryptocurrency.
Right.
The other problem, too, is that because the marketplace is made up of oil companies and energy companies and governments, the price of a carbon credit has been kept artificially low. So when you buy a carbon credit, you're not actually giving the people that much money to create new renewable energy with. Because the hope was the price would get higher so that more money, as we tried to keep balancing the carbon budget, more money would be going into renewables and projects, and that would scale up and up and up so that finally we'd get the transition we wanted. But actually it's been like kind of a piddling little line because the price of the carbon credit
is artificially low.
So that countries can trade them with each other and say, because they're the ones who are setting the prices. They're saying, no, we're all meeting our carbon budgets. Isn't that great?
Yeah, amazing.
Cheap, you know, like,
we did it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
hashtag neoliberalism.
Yeah.
Interesting. So, okay, this may be a bit of a divergence, but what would happen if, like, tomorrow, if Justin Trudeau just said, we are no longer producing oil, mm-hmm. we will sell off our oil reserves, and we what is already mined is mined, and we'll sell it off and use it. But as of tomorrow, we are doing full scale renewable energy projects. Hmm. I imagine there would be some like catastrophic economic fallout from that.
Yeah, definitely, you know, especially in the short term.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd get a massive recession in Alberta
as
people are like laid off of the energy industry. You would have a huge increase in the price of oil worldwide because the supply would be shrinking. And when there's smaller supply and the same amount of demand, the price goes up. That's like, you know, I'm an asshole in business school 101, which is my course you can take from my online university, Neoliberalism Academy.
Uh-huh.
check my GoFundMe page. And then I think you would also see, I mean, because we don't have the energy infrastructure in place to make it up with renewables, you would see like rolling blackouts, and we'd have to like import a lot of power until we could get all those projects built. It is possible. I mean, like, and this is the thing, is that in a different world, I think it would be theoretically possible for like the number of carbon credits you would earn by like not producing that oil, not spending the resources on extracting the oil, could maybe like help you get through that transition. Because like it's weird because it's like a negative thing, but think of it like this, like not producing carbon is the resource, right? It's like, even though it's like a negative activity, it's actually like the quantifiable resource in the carbon marketplace. So it's like, it would be like finding a bunch of gold.
Yeah,
suddenly
yeah.
not producing a bunch of carbon would be like finding a pile of gold. Right. Right?
It's so, like sobriety to an AA person.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah, except it's commodified.
3 years sober.
Except it's like literally a commodified product.
Right.
Like the commodity is not making carbon.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's weird. That's what one of the hardest things to get your head around is it's like here's a box of not making carbon. And mm-hmm. suddenly Canada discovered a million boxes of not making carbon that we can sell to other countries who are making carbon.
Right. So we perfected solar energy or whatever, and now it's like the new gold rush. But the way our money is coming in isn't through the like selling oil. It's through... Not producing the carbon.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Isn't that weird?
That is weird. And yeah. so we would have all these extra credits that we could then sell.
Like the
that,
whole,
and that's where the money's coming from?
I think in theory, like, yes, we could create, in a different world, we would create enough carbon credits that maybe you could pay for the transition to a clean energy economy. I think in the real world, the price of a carbon credit is so artificially low that that you couldn't do that. You'd have to take a huge cut to your standard of living because... oil in the short term, and because of the short-sightedness of the Alberta provincial governments of the last 50 years and of the federal governments, we're betting on oil really hard.
Right.
Like, it's like such a huge subsection of our economy that, we're really all in on it. And like, as you see, when there's a recession in Alberta, it's like a serious crisis. Like, it's really hits hard because it's, Alberta's fortunes are so staked on oil.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Wow. Okay. So that's that. The Kyoto Accord was where the cap and trade carbon
system was created.
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay.
Now, there were a couple big flaws with the Kyoto Accord. The biggest one was that the U.S. didn't like it and didn't agree to it.
Right.
Even though Bill Clinton helped draft it, in the end, it didn't pass Congress. Mm-hmm. And so the United States never ratified. That's the process for all of these accords is all the like world leaders meet up, they have to agree on what the thing's gonna be, which takes forever and doesn't always happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they've agreed on it, they take it back to their governments and their governments have to approve it, right? So Bill Clinton has to go back and get Congress to agree to the deal he's negotiated.
Right.
Which is probably a good thing.
For sure.
I think that's the way that should work.
I don't think, I don't know that one person should go off to another country, make a bunch of deals, and then like have a go. Well, it all went well, everybody.
You've just foreshadowed a very interesting chapter in the history of climate international agreements.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Ooh, are we going there now, or are we going
there
soon?
Later on.
Oh, take me.
So Bill Clinton, he can't get it ratified,
right?
So he pulls out.
Yeah, he's really frustrated. Goes home, gets a half BJ.
Yeah, that's right. Refuses to come.
Yeah,
furiously refuses to come.
Yeah, in defiance of God.
Yeah. And so from the beginning, the U.S. isn't signed on. The U.S. is responsible for 1/3 of the world's climate emissions. So that's a pretty big blow. If this is the agreement that's going to help.
The U.S. is responsible 1/3.
1/3.
What's China do?
China and the U.S. together produce probably like 2/3 to 3/4 of the world's emissions.
Holy fuck.
Yeah.
Talk about fucking gluttony.
Yeah.
Two-thirds to 3/4 for two fucking countries?
China's number one, U.S. is number two. I mean, and to be fair, think about it this way. China, okay, here's the statistics I'm looking at. In 2011, China emitted 88,715 million metric tons of carbon dioxide,
uh-huh.
right? The U.S. emitted 5,490 million tons of carbon dioxide, metric
right.
tons of carbon dioxide. So China is like a third bigger, more emissions than the U.S., but China is a market of a billion people.
I was going to say, China's a billion
States
people,
is
300 million
yeah, so
they, or whatever.
So the United States is 1/3 the size of China, but emits 2/3 of its carbon.
That just makes
the
me
next
fucking
closest,
sick.
Russia, number three, 1,788 million metric tons of emissions in 2011.
Right, I don't know what the population of Russia is, though. It's got to be similar to the U.S.
It's got
to
be similar, yeah. And that's number. Keep in mind, the distance between number three and number two, Russia is like, it emits like almost a quarter as much as
China's the, one and a half of the states, and the states is five times as
four
much.
Russians.
Or, four Russians.
Yeah, that's right.
And then everybody and then else everyone is else
lags, legs very far behind.
That's wow. Isn't that interesting?
Yep. So the U.S. is, because the U.S. and China are the, by far the largest global emitters, neither of them actually ended up signing on to Kyoto. Right. So there was a lot of skepticism from the very beginning that this would actually do anything if the two biggest, if two-thirds of the world's emissions were not accounted for in trying to solve this problem.
Right, right.
Russia ended up signing on final after a little while. It was one of the early things Vladimir Putin did was sign on to the Kyoto Protocol. So because of that, they actually felt like they had enough to go ahead and try it. Many of these countries did see reductions in their greenhouse gas emissions over this time, but generally speaking, they're not attributable to the actions of the Kyoto Accord and the measures in the Kyoto Accord. So, like, there was also the recession, which impacted everybody's greenhouse gases because just less stuff was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people switched from coal to natural gas in this time, which doesn't actually help, but does reduce it reduces emissions overall, but isn't actually solving the problem.
Right.
So right. those
You're
kind of
switching from heroin to crack.
Exactly. So, like the numbers were sort of fudged in a way. And Canada ended up actually pulling out of the Kyoto Protocol under Stephen Harper in 2010.
Right.
The justification being that there weren't enough countries that were big emitters signed on, and it was a waste of time.
Right. I know we don't like Mr. Harper, but does he have a point?
I mean,
if the U.S. isn't at the table, and if U.S., China, and Russia aren't at the table, I kind of understand.
The problem, though, is that, like, yes, he has sort of a point in that it sucks that this isn't going. Russia was on the table too. Russia was in, but it does suck that the largest emitters were not on board. But that doesn't mean we don't still have to transition as Canada.
Yeah, right? And you're right. And like there is solidarity. If every country except for the two biggest are signed on, and everybody goes, listen, you two fucking morons, like get with it.
Well, and that's you hit on literally the most important factor in climate diplomacy, which is like. Even though these are kind of like, I mean, the Kyoto Protocol had really hard targets, right? But one of the main values of these things, even if the Kyoto Protocol didn't succeed in helping us alleviate this problem, it's super good for like international peer pressure and shaming.
Yeah.
Because it collects all of the goals and information in one place that you can just point to, right? You can, instead of saying like making climate change this big amorphous fight, suddenly we have a goal.
Right.
And whether we succeed or not, we can say, are we at the target? Are we at 5% below 1990? You're lagging behind. Even if the U.S. isn't signed on to the Kyoto Protocol, you can still diss them with it. You know,
right,
you can be
right.
like, look how far they've spiraled out, right? It suddenly focuses in the fight and
right.
gives the fight tons of concrete numbers and backbones and goals.
Yeah. I guess there wouldn't, if they're not part of the agreement, there wouldn't be a punishment system. But like,
there is actually no punishment system.
Well, I was going to say there'd be like sanctions, stuff
yeah,
like that. So you go like, oh, we're not going to trade with you if you don't.
Yeah,
this
is always the stickiest thing. You're right on the money. This is a huge point of contention in climate diplomacy.
Mm-hmm.
And the Kyoto Protocol did not come with sanctions. And it's often, usually the battle line is between developing countries and developed countries. Developed countries do not want sanctions because they don't want to be overly obligated to reduce the size of their oil economies. Whereas developing countries generally, it's easier for them to meet their targets because they don't have as much infrastructure that uses oil.
Mm-hmm.
And also they do bear generally the cost of climate change more. So they want harder, more direct action.
Yeah.
But no, there was no enforcement mechanism in Kyoto.
Right.
And this is how, and in this way, climate diplomacy differs from stuff like chemical weapons, right? Like a chemical weapons agreement is a similar kind of thing to climate change where everyone agrees to not use a chemical weapon. And if any one person uses one, the international community jumps on them, they sanction them, they, you know, like there's all kinds of things that can happen at that point. Unfortunately, the climate justice doesn't have that yet. Maybe it was kind of a key factor in having it exist at all.
Right, right. Yeah. So now enter the Paris Accord.
Yeah, so first, in 2009 in Copenhagen, they tried to create another climate accord because the Kyoto Protocol only lasts until 2020. That was like when it kind of ends. So, and it was always intended to be a first stage. There was going to be another thing negotiated later.
Yeah, bring it down to 15%
or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Then we'll take stock and we'll see what the next goal needs to be.
Yeah.
Copenhagen in 2009 failed. They didn't reach an agreement.
Right, because Harper was a dick there at that point.
Right? Yeah, that's right.
I remember reading all about that on the news, how he was dodging questions, just being a fucking smug ass.
Yeah, and a huge part of the fight was that, the developing nations didn't like hard targets.
Yeah.
They didn't like having the 5% below 1990 number because none of them actually really met it. And it was easy to bludgeon them with it. And then the other thing was over enforcement mechanisms. They didn't want enforcement mechanisms, and so they couldn't compromise on that with the developing nations. Fast forward to 2015, the Paris conference happens to try to find a new agreement. Right. This time they succeed.
Also, NHL 2015,
amazing game. Yeah, it's a great game. So what was the difference? Well, basically, the developing nations agreed to a compromise on this. So what the Paris Agreement says, it's kind of funny to talk about. Because what it says is like...
Bonjour, je m'appelle Paris Agreement.
How did you know? The Paris Climate Agreement is like the homeschooling of climate agreements. By that I mean... It has no hard targets, but it's just like everyone agrees you're going to go home and you're going to make your own target.
Right. And everybody does well on the test, but nobody's socially adjusted.
Exactly, right. It's like, so basically every country's going to agree to go set their own goal for emissions reduction.
Oh.
And then they're going to, basically the Paris Agreement said 192 countries are signed on. Every single one. And they're all going to go back and set their own target for emissions reductions. And then they're going to report on those reductions to kind of like a neutral third body of examiners.
Right.
And from there is no enforcement mechanism. There's no punishment system of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
There is like a loose framework into like this punishment system, but it's not – there's like – there's like a disaster relief kind of element to it, but there's no like liability, right? So it's like, there's kind of some resources being pooled to help climate related disasters, but it's like, but they made sure to write in that like rich countries aren't responsible for tsunamis and poor countries, like basically that piece of legalese. Right.
So this is like every conversation I've ever had with anyone who's like, I got this idea for a screenplay. And then they like tell me about the screenplay and they never end up writing it.
Exactly.
You know, like you announce, there is that sort of that, I don't know, not an adage, but like a, I don't know, savvy advice of don't state your goals.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, never say out loud, my goal is to be in a TV show.
Yeah.
Because when you say it, people go, oh, yeah, good for you. That's a good idea. And then you go, then you feel in your heart, you're like, oh, I feel like I've already accomplished that.
Yeah, yeah.
I've already received the congratulations.
Right. And that's kind of the danger of the Paris conference is like, I actually had no idea. I was a bit of a basic bitch about this. Like, I knew it existed, but I didn't know what it was. And when I read it, I was like, that's what this is? Holy shit. Because it's so vague.
Right.
Right? All it is a vague framework where everyone agrees to do something, and then they also agree to police each other about it. And
right.
Like, and basically, the only real enforcement mechanism is, like, international shame and peer pressure.
Right. So what's the nacho volcano Donald Trump complaining about when he says it's a bad deal for the U.S.?
Well, this is what's so funny, is, like, all his complaints were... Every point he has against the Paris Climate Agreement, Barack Obama specifically negotiated all the things he has a problem with. So when he was like, it forces us into a deal, it's like deliberately left open to not force anyone into a deal. And in fact, Barack Obama was facing a hostile Congress at the time. And part of the criticism, this is the main criticism of it, is Barack Obama wrote the Paris Climate Agreement was drafted in such a way that Barack Obama did not need the approval of Congress to sign on to it, unlike the Kyoto Protocol,
right.
Because it didn't involve any government spending into an international agreement.
Right.
Right? So they didn't have to ask Congress for approval. Barack Obama just did it by himself.
Right.
Pissed a lot of people off.
Sure.
So I think that's what Donald Trump's mad about. And also Donald Trump's entire career is basically Obama haterade.
Yeah, man. I was watching Jimmy Kimmel last night, I suppose, and Al Franken was on there. And Al Franken was talking about, first of all, I've seen Al Franken. He's been pitching his book lately, and so he's been in a lot of talk shows lately. And I've been looking and being like, I think he's going to run for president.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was talking about, he's like the main goal of a politician shouldn't be elections. It shouldn't be like this is our policy versus their policy. It should be to improve people's lives. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump is, I mean, I'm not really saying anything that wasn't said on Jimmy Kimmel last night, but Donald Trump is over and over and over again, you know, like this $6 billion proposed cut to Medicare,
right?
And like, you know, and Congress turned around and added $2 billion instead of taking away the $4 billion.
Yeah,
and it's like it's fucking aggravating, you know. It's like that you're putting. With regard to the Medicare, you're putting, you know, millions of people at risk that are going to not be covered, and they're going to be sick and they're going to die. You're going to hurt millions of your own people just to, like, in this weird dick measuring contest of politics.
Well, that's the thing.
And likewise with fucking climate change.
The whole thing is a fucking pissing contest now. Nobody's governing anymore. It's all this weird, stupid blood sport that America plays. Because, like, Obamacare was a compromise bill with the Republicans. It was like a market-based, right-wing, capitalist approach to this problem of trying to get uninsured people insurance.
Right.
That was the whole objective. And they ruthlessly compromised any kind of left-wing solution to that in order to give the Republicans a right-wing compromise. And now the Republicans, like, have to attack and destroy it because all they have is hating Obama and hating the left. They don't have any actual policies other than, like, enriching the 1%. That is also their policy.
Right, but, like, hashtag Obamacare. Check out our Obamacare episode.
And then and then it's the same with Paris. Like, Barack Obama negotiated a super, super manipulatable Paris Agreement, right? He got the U.S.
How so?
in the sense that if a Republican president could say, I'll tell you our Paris Agreement goals. Suck on these nuts. And then it's like, here's our quarterly report on how our goals are going. The nuts are fucking wet with spit. You know, like, he could have fucking said anything.
Right.
He could have set the goals as anything.
Right.
And even if he didn't do it, there's no enforcement mechanism.
Right.
So nothing would have happened. And a good leader would have just been like, I mean, maybe the whole thing is then that, like, Trump's a climate skeptic and it costs him nothing then to, like, remove the U.S. from the Paris Agreement. If he doesn't care about it, it's something easy that he can do just to get points.
Right.
But he's fucking us all over.
So it seems to me, and I don't actually know how effective, like, the U.N. is,
right,
but it sounds like that's what we're doing in our next episode.
Yeah, we're going to do the U.N. next.
But it sounds to me like there is a need for, like, a climate change U.N., or at least to get the U.N. involved.
There
or
is, like, that. You know, I mean, like, the U.N. has a lot of resources on climate change, a lot of stuff, you know, like the cap-and-trade market. That's all done through the U.N.
Yeah.
Like, new carbon credits are created when the U.N. is like, yes, that did what you said. Here is the carbon credit.
Right.
It's like the mint that prints the carbon credits, kind of thing. So the UN's super involved on climate change. It's just that the problem is the UN itself is also structured in a way that gives the United States a huge amount of control over actual things that get done, especially sanctions and repercussions, right?
Because all them vetoes, right?
Yeah.
Who's got the vetoes? U.S., Russia.
Yeah, on the UN Security Council, the United States, Russia, France, Germany, the UK, I think. And then it rotates. There's like a couple of rotating seats in the UN Security Council. I don't know who's got it right now,
but
always United States and Russia.
Right. But climate change wouldn't be covered by the Security Council.
Well, no, but like that's for armed intervention. But like in theory, like sanctions would be, you know what I mean? The problem is that countries don't want to sanction the US. There's a lot the US can do to make their lives bad.
Right.
You know, like very few countries sanction the US.
Right.
And so the U.S. can kind of do what it wants. But the problem is when you unhook the U.S. from the Paris Agreement, like, it'll be really hard to get it back in because everyone's pissed at the U.S. for leaving.
Right.
And Trump even said, he's like, if I can negotiate a better one, we're going to negotiate a better one. They already negotiated that one. It was the first one.
Right.
Everything he could want was negotiated already. There's no way they're going to give him the win of letting him have another one for free.
You know what I mean?
So that's annoying.
Yeah.
What were we just talking about? Oh my God, I had a thing that I wanted to say and it slipped my mind.
Oh
yeah, just that, like, America is always like a real bully in international relations in this way, and they always insist on things always being stacked in their favor, especially with regards to like consequences for them. So like, America doesn't approve of the International Criminal Court, where you can be tried for war crimes. And there's an American law on the books from 2002 under the George W. Bush presidency that says if an American ever gets tried for war crimes, America will invade the Netherlands and extradite them back to the United States, like with the army. It's called...
Invade the Netherlands.
Invade the Netherlands.
Why?
Because they're like, no American will ever be tried for a war crime internationally.
Right, but what does the Netherlands have to do with it?
That's where the International Criminal Court is.
Oh.
Just like. Yeah, that's right. It's like, if you hurt my friend, I'm going to kill this guy over here. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, no. It's like, just holding the Netherlands.
Like, no, that's where the court physically is.
Everyone in the Netherlands is like, what? Yeah. Why? What's going on?
I thought we were friends. We had the wooden shoes. Don't you love the goofy accents?
Okay, wow, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, so like, literally, the U.S. is like, never try one of our people for a war crime ever, or we will invade you and take them back.
Like, wow.
With the army. It's a law. It's a law that got passed.
Ugh.
Right.
Oh.
So Richard. Even with all of that, they still successfully, everyone's like, okay, America.
Right.
Have it. That's fine. All you have to do is tell us what you want to do and then tell us how you're doing.
Yeah.
And even that was too much for these people. Like, keep in mind, on our last episode, we went through in a lot of detail how, like, even if you don't believe climate change is happening or a problem, there's a lot of reasons to get off oil, and that's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
These people still are so fucking broken in their brains, they will not even give it that much.
Right.
To, like... a set your own goals project. They can't even do right. that.
A work at your own pace yeah, school.
That's right.
Right. They're like, not good enough.
A fucking online University of Athabasca online course.
Right.
In climate change.
I want to do nothing and have nobody watching.
That's right. Exactly. Right. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. They're like, no, we're going to do whatever the fuck we want. Fuck you guys. I don't give a shit if everyone dies.
Right.
Go eat shit and die. Yeah.
Right. Wow. Okay, well, good. This fills me with optimism.
I know, it's a bit bleak. I mean, the truth is that, like, the only things we can do, I think the push has to come from the ground up. Now, I mean, governments are doing things. You know, the Paris Agreement is proceeding.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the cap and trade system is still part of this, so it's been preserved and it still exists. Other things that are being tried are, like, carbon taxes. You've heard of this.
Yeah.
All that means is... anytime you do something that burns carbon, that uses gas, you pay more to the government.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest carbon tax in the world is actually in British Columbia, my home province.
Yo.
And it got a lot of attention in 2016 for being a big success. But then actually there was a lot of research that was like, no, this is not a huge success. This is a bit depressing too. I mean, like, the BC carbon tax fails in a couple key ways. Even though it is like a strong tax, it hasn't raised over the years, which is one of the things you're supposed to, in theory, be doing, is like you start taxing the carbon, then you keep raising the tax so that you're creating a pressure in the market that makes other energy more viable.
Right.
Right? You're just making oil unviable in the market and you want other stuff to become viable.
Right.
They didn't do that. And then the other key was they didn't reuse the carbon tax to like raise a bunch of money and build a bunch of other energy. Instead, they just gave people a tax break.
Right.
So they didn't actually raise any money with the carbon tax. They just gave it back to people. But here's the catch. The catch is a carbon tax is what's called a regressive tax.
Right.
As opposed to a progressive tax. Now, what does that mean? A regressive tax affects people with less money more than people with more money. And here's how that works. Our income taxes in Canada and in most places, I think, are progressive taxes.
Right.
That means if you have more money, you pay more. And the way that it works in our system is there's brackets of taxes. So, and everyone pays the same in the brackets. This is one of the things that it's funny about. People don't even understand this sometimes about taxes. Sometimes you see like a meme or something that's like the tax brackets, say the tax brackets at $50,000. And it's like, they're like, if you're going to make $51,000, you're going to make less money than if you make $49,000. Because if you make $49,000, you'll pay 10% of tax.
Right.
But if you pay $51,000, suddenly you're paying 15% of tax and you have less overall money than if you made 49.
Right.
Right? That's not true.
Right.
Because it doesn't work like that.
Right.
The way it works is if the first bracket is from $10,000. You don't pay tax under $10,000. If you make under $10,000, you don't pay tax, right? But the thing is, everyone gets that. So the first $10,000 everyone makes, you don't pay tax.
Right, right. Then, so if you make $51,000 a year, you pay 15% tax or whatever on the
$1,000. That's right.
Right.
And then you go through every bracket paying the correct amount of tax for the whole amount of that bracket. And only paying the higher amounts on the amounts that are in that bracket.
Right.
Right? That's a progressive tax. Because what that means is that people who have less overall money pay kind of like a fair share of what they own. Whereas people who have more money pay a fair share of what they own. And right. They pay more overall, but percentage-wise, you know, it affects them in a different in less it doesn't put them in danger of like not having enough money to live.
Right, right, right.
A carbon tax is a regressive tax because everyone pays the same tax on oil regardless of how much money you make. So if you're poor and suddenly the price of gas goes up a dollar, that hits you so much harder than for someone who's rich. The price of gas goes up a dollar, they complain about it. It doesn't like seriously affect them, but you're paying a way larger percentage of your income.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because it's the same for everybody, right? And so that's one of the problems with the carbon tax is A, it like really hit poor people hard in BC. And then B, it didn't even invest more in renewable energy.
Right. So how much is the maximum tax bracket?
I think it's $250,000.
So everything above $250,000 you make, you pay whatever.
Whatever the rate is. Yeah, it's one rate for everything above $250,000.
Right. But again, as you get higher and higher in that number, that percentage actually means less.
That's right.
Right.
That's
so right. So it's sort of a threat. Like once you're out of the Earth's atmosphere, it's a lot easier to propel yourself through space.
Exactly. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Once you make over $1 million a year, all of a sudden it's like the tax you're paying on it is actually much, much smaller.
Yeah, that's right. It becomes kind of like the progressiveness kind of like tapers off after a while.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That's, I mean, like we said before, Jean-Luc Mélenchon in France, he had an idea for a 99% tax bracket over €1 million. Like once you start making €1 million, you pay 99% tax on it because you don't need it. You don't need that.
Yeah, great.
You don't need that to live, or you could do a lot of things with that million. Congrats.
Yeah, you did. You
this
beat
year,
the game.
You get to figure out how you spend $1 million this year. Next year, you probably get to do it all again.
Yeah.
Just live that life.
Yeah.
That's not a bad life. Nobody's scoffing at that life.
No, God, no.
So that's one of the problem with the carbon tax we've had so far. It just hasn't been implemented in the way where it's going to, again, just like with the cap and trade, the idea was they kind of snowball and get us into a transition. But it hasn't done that because the money wasn't raised to invest back into renewable energy, so it's not snowballing.
Right.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so where does that leave us, Richard?
I think that leaves us, like, we need to, as people,
yeah.
Exert pressure on our governments and on our politicians to basically just show them that we're paying attention. Like once you and again, these are technical things you hear, cap and trade, carbon tax, it's not clear what they're supposed to be. So now here's that information. Mm. Let's just keep track of if these goals are being met, if people are being honest, and if this transition is really happening, because we need to all kind of be the warriors in this fight, you know, like it's our world. We're all going to get fucked if this goes off badly. Like some of the more pessimistic things that I've looked at say that by 2040 or 2050, if the rate of warming continues at the rate that it's at, so we're talking 25 years, we're going to lose a third of the world's agricultural production. We have 7 billion people to feed. We make enough food to feed them all now. If we lose a third of that, of those crops, a lot of people are going to die of starvation.
Yeah.
Like we're looking at that soon.
Well, yeah, I was reading the Tim Ferriss article. He was talking about this company that this guy bought. So this guy bought this company. It was a failing company, and it was going down. And no matter all the changes he made from a managerial point of view, weren't making a difference. And so in sort of a last ditch effort, he posted publicly on like the warehouse floor so the workers could see it. They're like, this is what we're producing, this is what we're selling, this is why this business is going to go out of business. And every week he would post the new chart of like, this is how this shit is going down. And with that single change, he saw the company turn around and like quadrupled his money or whatever. Right. And the premise there is that what can be measured can be managed.
Yes.
So like you can't change something until you understand and can see the numbers and see the impact.
Yeah.
And I think that's especially again like you said, with all these terms, the cap and trade, carbon tax, carbon credits.
I know, your head spins.
Sometimes I feel like the job of politics feels like its job is to lose me a little bit. You know,
100%.
To make me not pay attention because it's all boring and technical.
Yeah, 100%.
And I feel that's, you know, a bit, disingenuous. So it becomes more and more important to understand these things so the more people that understand it, you're right. The more people that understand
then they can't squirm away from you.
Exactly.
You go, no, I know exactly what I want out of you right now, so give me a straight answer.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
We're seeing that with the fight for single-payer healthcare in America is just the ball is rolling on it, right? The momentum is rolling. More and more mainstream Democrats are coming around because finally the information has gotten to enough people, ordinary people, that they're not letting people off the hook anymore. And I think the momentum is building for a serious fight for single-payer healthcare. I think it's going to be a massive wedge issue in the 2020 election, mm-hmm. and I think we could see it in the next administration if the king of the orangutans goes down. Wow,
King Louis,
that's something
is
funny
his
to
name.
Think about, hey, like that election.
My God.
My heart started beating faster just thinking about it.
The election between...
The next presidential election in America.
Oh, my God, baby.
Wow.
What if it was Al Franken versus Donald Trump?
I mean, would his monster be out there campaigning with him, too? That might be a little off-putting.
You're right.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know who the strongest contender is going to be. Honestly, a lot of people have been saying Bernie. I don't know. I think the mainstream centrist Democrats he's kind of in bad shape with them. I don't know enough about Al Franken to feel that confident about him. I know he's like, you know, a quick-witted, more
comedy
left-leaning
guy.
Guy. Yeah, yeah. I think he could stand a chance if he wanted to run.
Yeah.
I think Mark Zuckerberg is going to try to run. That's terrifying, like deeply terrifying.
Yeah.
I don't see a strong Democratic Party, to be honest. I don't see a strong contender emerging. Kamala Harris is another. She's a California senator that a lot of people think might be prepping the overtures of a run. She's problematic in her ways, but she's coming around. She's being pulled left by the conversation, which is the correct functioning of democracy. Like, this was Hillary's problem.
Right.
When you have a huge divided base in your party between the left and the center, and you're the centrist candidate, you just won the nomination. The way democracy is supposed to work is you're supposed to give the leftist people some of what they want and then get them to the polls.
Right.
She refused to do that and she lost. Like, that's what happened. I will not look at it any other way. I've researched this. I've looked at it. My thinking is based in facts and analysis and the functioning of the democracies. Like,
right.
Russia wasn't responsible for that loss. It was the fact that she didn't do democracy.
Right.
And that was her problem.
Before
we wrap up, I want to talk about, just do a little section on, after we transition, how do we get the carbon out of the air? There's a couple, like, just interesting ideas that we need to talk about. How do you get the carbon out of the air? Obviously, you plant trees, the trees absorb it. That's the long term.
You make the hole in the ozone layer really big so it all just...
And then you close it really fast.
Close
that door really fast, honestly, though, you're not far off of, like... I mean, no one's saying, let's punch a hole in the ozone layer and let that carbon just rock and roll. But there's this concept called geoengineering, which is kind of what it sounds like. It's like... messing with the earth. building up carbon dioxide is like a form of geoengineering. We're just doing it without meaning to do it, and it's snowballing out of control.
We're naturals.
Exactly. But But there's a whole kind of line of thinking about how we can finally save our own asses. And geoengineering is like a sort of frightening but interesting aspect of that conversation. So how do we get carbon out of the air? The long-term thing is plant more forests. If there's forests, they'll slowly take the carbon out. You know, like they'll keep the carbon cycle manageable. Mm-hmm. And that'll save us in the very long run. I think that's going to be the ultimate answer will be involve a lot of reforestation and tending to forests. In the short term, we can do a thing called carbon capture, which is where you basically like suck a bunch of air up, separate the carbon, release the stuff back out, suck a bunch more air up, keep sucking the carbon out. Once you got like a big squishy ball of carbon, you bury it in the ground. You just put that shit in the ground where it can't hurt. You give it a timeout. It can't hurt anybody anymore. You just put that fucking carbon in back in the ground where it came from.
Right.
So that's one carbon capture. That's
and
called.
Then
carbon sequestration.
And you're setting people up 10,000 years from now.
They find that carbon.
Everybody gets some fucking diamonds, man.
Can you imagine? That's gonna be like, or like if it's still in there, it's gonna be like the original. Like it's like an opening, like the mummy's tomb.
Yeah.
Except it's gonna just be like all the carbon's gonna go back in the fucking atmosphere.
Fuck! Close it.
Yeah, literally Pandora's box. It's like the box of all the carbon we finally took out of the fucking atmosphere.
Pandora's box wasn't a myth; it was a prophecy.
Yeah, like 10,000 years from now, people are gonna be like, there wasn't carbon. There was no carbon. That was a metaphor. You know, they were using that as a story to like teach each other about the values of their time. You know,
right.
It's just a myth. And then they'll find the fucking carbon. Oh my God, what a nightmare. Okay, and I just want to talk about one more thing too. There's this crazy idea, I think. I mean, cool, but terrifying. You've probably heard in Australia in the Great Barrier Reef, the reef is dying really fast.
I thought it was pronounced dead.
Yeah, that was a bit of a like drama queen, like right. The kid in your drama class you kind of roll your eyes at.
Right, like there's like a bunch of doctors on a boat and like one puts his stethoscope in the water and he's like, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It's dead.
Yeah. It's not 100% dead. It's dying way faster than they thought.
Right.
It's dying at the rate they predicted like 20 or 30 years from now. So right. It's dying quick.
Well, how old is the Great Barrier Reef?
8. No, it's like tens of thousands of years old.
Right, but what's getting up there?
Yeah, what's happening is that because the ocean's getting warmer, it's like killing the things that make the reef reproduce. So it's not reproducing; it's like drying itself out because all the living parts of it are dying.
Right.
So that we're watching that process happen, and it's because there's more heat, so the water's warmer.
But what's happening to the clownfish, Richard?
What's happening to the clownfish?
Let's just say Nemo was easy to find. He was floating at the surface of the water right by the reef. No, the clownfish are dead, Jamie.
Dark.
All of them, yeah. So get this, though.
Yeah.
There's this wackadoo solution that somebody proposed called cloud brightening. And the theory is you get a big ship, bunch of big ships in the neighborhood of the reef. They absorb water from the ocean and then put more salt in it, extra salt, fire that salt into the air as vapor. The clouds get brighter. The clouds reflect more sun back out into space and give us a bit of a break. We make the clouds brighter, Jamie.
What?
And then the clouds shield us from the sun's rays and help us slow
by putting
down.
Salt in the clouds?
Yeah. If the clouds have more salt concentration, they're more reflective.
Oh, my God. That's, like, such a cartoon-like solution.
Yeah.
Like, do they do it with Zeppelins?
That's right. It's just a huge red button.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's, like, the kind of thing people are pitching. And, I mean, like, I think that maybe that could buy us some time. Like, that's an interesting notion. It's also, like, wasn't our problem that we were putting a bunch of extra shit into the sky?
Sure.
I can't help but also think, wasn't our problem also that if the sun's all that gets in, won't it bounce off the bottom of the cloud even more also and stay in?
Sure.
Like, but the scientists, you know, there's a reason they're pitching this kind of thing. But in the long term, let's say we get to the point where we have zero emissions everywhere, but there's still all the extra carbon in the air. Things are still melting.
Right.
We're an entire 25% to 30% past the highest recorded level of carbon we've ever been able to measure
right.
in recent history. this is the kind of thing we do. We can do the carbon sequestration. We can suck it out of the air and bury it. And then if we brighten the clouds for a little bit, you know, we cool the earth off for a little bit. We let the forests do their thing. That's the eventually that could be the way we get ourselves back to balance.
Right. It does feel a little bit like I've got mice in my house, so I'm going to release cats. And now I've got too many cats, so I'm going to release dogs.
Yeah,
and now
yeah.
I've got too many dogs, so I'm going to release gorillas.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, it is a little bit like that for sure. I think that the advantage we would have with something like cloud brightening is like, yes, we're releasing more wackadoo shit into the air, but at least we're keeping an eye on it from the very beginning. You know what I mean? I feel like the whole thing about carbon was people were like, that's not a problem.
It's not on the
over here.
Yeah, it's in the air now. It's not for me. It's for God to deal with.
Look, this car's got a TV in it. You'll never have to hear your fucking kids talk again.
Cough, cough, cough.
Yeah. So that's climate change.
Ba, 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 ba.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, I mean, the whole U.S. being a bully on the climate change issue is, like, that's one of the more disheartening things. And I'm sure, like, China's being a bully as well, but it doesn't sound like as big a bully as the U.S., but, like...
Yeah, they have a developing market, so it's easier for them to, like, because they're choosing, they're kind of they've been in the place in their country's development history. There's a lot of Marxist critique of these terms, which we should not get into right now, but it's a really interesting one that's like developing nations were kept developing on purpose so that developed nations could steal their resources, and then it makes it sound like they're not oppressed nations, they're just developing. You know, like, anyway. But China, you know, it's like for the first time, we're supplying a major power project to this part of China. Do we build a huge coal plant or do we build a natural dam, a hydroelectric dam? Well, the choice is a dam now. So they found it easier to, because they're developing infrastructure from the ground up. It's like, let's start with renewables. That's happening a lot more in China.
Yeah, let's not go through the whole coal thing. Yeah. Let's jump to the next page.
Their economy is so fucking huge that they still emit a shitload of carbon.
For sure.
But that is kind of like, it's an easier thing for them to.
Yeah, you know. I mean, that's sort of... Yeah, I guess it feels like wrangling cats. You know what I mean?
It is. It's international diplomacy. But you know what else is depressing? There's only three countries in the world that are not signed on to the Paris Accord. The U.S. One of the other ones is Syria.
Sure.
Because it's like busy. We kept trying to call. We got through to somebody once, but
they're like, it's not a good time right now. Can I just take your number down and listen? I've got it on my answering machine. Okay, I'll call you back in like 5 minutes.
Yeah, the other one's like I can't remember, Zambia or some tiny country also.
Right.
It's not great company, the U.S., is it? It's kind of like the imperial system.
Yeah,
you know?
totally. Yeah. Oh, man. Okay, well.
Everyone else is in.
Right.
Everyone else is going to try. That's all we can do. And all we can do is, you know, learn this stuff and make sure it happens. Because, fuck, I mean, this is the thing of our time. This is the great, this is the moral issue, the crisis of our time. This is it.
Yeah. I encourage people to engage in conversations about this kind of thing. And, like, I've become more and more aware of, as we talked about a little bit on our last climate change issues, like value projecting or value, I call it that. What did you call it? Value.
Virtue signaling.
Virtue signaling. Yeah, I would encourage people to have conversations about it and not in a way that's meant to make you sound smart or make you sound, like, elevated, but in a way that's meant to, like, learn more yourself in conversations about it. And, come from a point of not knowing and you know, having this information that Richard has bestowed and I have attempted to ruin, you know, you can have a bit more of an educated conversation.
No matter where you live, there were groups where you are who are trying to fight climate change. Those groups would be thrilled if you got in touch and said, hey, can I sit in while you guys have a meeting? Can you do this? It's a bit of a leap, but I promise you that it's an interesting and exciting leap to get involved with movement politics, because often those people are in your region, your neighborhood, fighting the fights that actually are related to you, the ways that climate change impacts you. There will be people there trying to fight that battle. And so I encourage you to get in touch, sit in on a meeting, have some conversations, meet some people, And go from there. It's a rewarding thing. I took that leap earlier this year after Donald Trump was elected, and I've been very happy with it.
Yeah. Well, this has been great, Rick.
Yeah, Jamie.
I suppose we'll see you next week.
Yeah.
I hope we're
hanging out tomorrow, yeah.
Yeah, we'll get some ramen.
Okay, if you like this episode, hit us up with some comments. You know, sound off. On SoundCloud, explain it to Jamie. Twitter at Explain Jamie. Gmail, explainitojamie@gmail.com.
We're on Facebook. Just throw it into Google. Please recommend this to your friends.
Yeah, share it around.
Share it around. It does us a great deal of good. We are forever grateful. I think we're aiming to get a Patreon account up and going.
We got some exciting changes coming, so.
Yeah, stay tuned.
Not like changes, but like, please give us money.
Yeah. And until next time, I'm Jamie.
I'm Richard.
This has been Explain It to Jamie.